The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Welcome to We the People Radio on another sunny Sunday afternoon.
Welcome.
Unless you live anywhere but California.
Yeah, California, we're mandated to have sunshine 320 days a year.
Yes.
We've had our rain for the season.
Nuttiness, total nuttiness. So, today we're talking about the health care bill. We haven't been really, I don't know, we've kind of let it slide for a while.
It's not going away, but it might go away.
I know. Yeah. We're creeping up on the going away part.
Yep, we're creeping up.
And then second hour, we have Patrick Wood back with us. He is going to, we just ran out of time last week about how we could fix the technocracy problem. So he has come back on graciously this week to spend another hour and we can figure out what to do. But we have Dr. Jason Fodeman with us this morning. If you want to join us on the chat room, we take questions through there. You can call us or you can chat with us. If you want to jump on the chat room, it's wethepeopleradio.us and click on this week or the tab on the top. Hold on. What is today? The 25th. It says January 25th. Either way you go, you'll see a bar there that says click here to listen and chat live. Great way to do it. And if you have to go somewhere and you really want to catch the show, come back to the page at about 2:30, and we'll have the archive up. So phone number, before we forget, is 530-605-4567. You're joining Aaron.
And Bill.
And Bob.
Hello, Bob.
Good afternoon, Aaron and Bob and Bill.
Aaron and Bob.
Yeah, we're past the good morning part. At least we're not doing that anymore. Yeah.
Or at least I got afternoon right.
Yeah.
All right.
You did good.
So let's get the good doctor on here. He is a member of Doc Squads. I don't know what that means, but I want to find out. And a former health policy fellow at the Heritage Foundation. So he's been writing about the health care bill since I think the earliest articles I found were like 2009, and I listed those on the webpage. So if you guys want to read some other things, and there are a couple of YouTube videos as well. Dr. Fodeman, are you in there?
I sure am. Thanks so much for having me, guys.
You bet. Good afternoon. Thanks for being on.
Thanks a million. So what is Doc Squads anyway?
Sure. So Doc Squads is basically an organization founded by Joel Strom, who's out in Beverly Hills, and he's a dentist, actually. And basically his mission of his organization, which I think is really great, is really trying to empower doctors and trying to get doctors more involved as far as really getting the message out about how laws, regulations, the ACA is affecting doctors, affecting their patients, and affecting just the practice of medicine in general. So I think it's a really great, needed organization, and I'm a part of the Arizona chapter, which is where I'm based out of.
Nice. And you had, part of what set off this interview was an article you had in The Hill, and it was titled "Healthcare for Me, but Possibly Not for Thee." And as a former English teacher, I do love the use of "thee" whenever we can, work it in.
I was able to fit it in, so it was perfect. I try to use it about once every 6 months or so. I was doomed. So.
Hence, it will fall into disuse. Well,
from what I've been reading, it may not be for thee.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Sure. So basically the article you're talking about, which was published in The Hill, basically I took, some of you guys might have heard about how President Obama had a sore throat recently, and I basically took the care that he got and kind of contrasted that with the care that your listeners might get under the ACA. Now, President Obama, he had a sore throat, and he went to Walter Reed and had a very thorough workup with, from what we understand, an ENT consult, a fiber optic exam, had a CAT scan, and
wow.
Of course, as the leader of the free world, President Obama, he's not a group of positive politics, but definitely deserves top-notch medical care, and there's no question about that, but... Well, first off, as a physician, I you know, do my best to provide top-notch medical care to anybody who walks through the door. And unfortunately, due to various provisions of the ACA, which are still getting hashed out, I think there's a lot of ways that that's going to get harder for a physician like me to do for John Q. Payson, unfortunately.
Well, I know my doctor, my personal doctor, who shall remain unnamed, recently had a note on his counter that said he would no longer bill the California exchange insurance, that you'd have to pay up front and then you collect your money.
So my doctor never did take the insurance. He just said no to everything. If you want to come to me, good for you. Well, you bill your own insurance.
You can't blame him.
I don't.
The amount that they're getting paid when they're getting paid is a fraction of what they can survive on. So, you know, if you want to, you want a doctor, it looks like in a lot of cases you're going to have to just pay.
Well, and doesn't it limit the types of things you can do for people?
Sure, and there's definitely some parts of the law that could have that impact. And again, the kind of the devil's in the details, so to speak. But those are some of the things that I talk about in this piece in The Hill. And basically, one provision of the law is the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute. And basically, the mandate of that is to conduct government-sponsored research comparing the efficacy of various surgical and medical interventions. And prima facie, you know, on its face, well, that seems reasonable. That doesn't seem so bad. But again, it kind of depends how that research is ultimately used. And when you have a Medicare system that has 40-some-odd trillion dollars in unfunded liabilities and costs are exploding, I think the fear of mine and the fear of other providers out there as well who are really kind of paying attention is that government entities like Medicare and Medicaid that are looking to kind of save money might go out there and use this research to kind of deny care to individuals. And there's several ways that perhaps could be done. One way is they could take this research and for those quote-unquote less efficacious treatments, just outright deny coverage for them, say, we're not going to cover those. Or another option, which could perhaps have a similar effect, would be to take those kind of quote-unquote less efficacious treatments and say, we'll pay for them, but we're going to pay physicians less. So that would kind of put physicians in a bind where it would basically dissuade, and depending on what we're talking about, possibly dissuade severely physicians from ordering those tests that their patients need and want. And I think the real kind of fundamental problem with this type of approach to healthcare is this research, it's not based on the individual patient. It's not based on the patient sitting in the exam room. It's not based on you. It's based on the average patient.
Yeah.
And the average patient, unfortunately, can be very, very different from the individual patient. Patients respond differently to different medicines, and that's kind of the art of medicine as opposed to the science. And this type of approach to cutting costs really just ignores that.
Yeah, and that is happening now. I mean,
that's always
there's a lot of things that they just won't pay for. So, I mean, my doctor told me, he said, it's going to come to a point where I won't be able to treat you anymore because, the tests or the treatments that I may recommend for you, they won't pay me for. So if you want, me to treat you, you have to pay for that out of pocket. Otherwise you're going to be treated by a bureaucrat.
Sure, sure. And that is some of the shift we're seeing with concierge medicine, direct pay models. And I think those type of mediums of care, A, provide very high quality care that's more patient-centered, that patients like, that doctors like. But again, kind of the fear as someone who's really kind of following the policy is that we just have the ACA that established 159 new committees, agencies, programs that it's very likely that as more doctors do go in that direction and as more doctors do opt out of the system, that one of those agency programs or committees is going to say, not so fast, you can't do that, and make it illegal one way or another. And I think that's a very kind of legitimate fear.
Is it? I think I remember that it was not legal in Canada to pay cash for service. You're not allowed to kind of go around the system. You've got to be in it, or you've got to leave the country and go somewhere else.
Sure, and that's what we're seeing. We're seeing where a lot of Canadian patients who don't want to wait 4 months for an MRI or 6 months for orthopedic surgery because they're in pain. So they come across the border and they come here. And so basically what that is, it's kind of like a two-tier system where those with money, those with power, those with the resources who have access to other mediums, they can still get that kind of high-quality care, kind of like our president can. But again, John Q. patient, unfortunately, especially those without access, without the money, without the power, without the connections, they're going to basically be stuck in the system. And I think the real kind of shame here, guys, is that, yes, there were problems. I mean, there were costs were exploding, largely due to Medicare and the third-party payer system. But irrespective of that, I mean, costs were exploding. There were 49 million uninsured people in this country, and the efforts definitely needed to be to bring more people into the system. But for the most part, 90% of people or so in this country had health insurance, and 80 to 85% of those rated their coverage as good or excellent. So most people had insurance. Most people had a doctor, and they liked their insurance, and they liked their doctor. And parenthetically speaking, why else would the president spend so much time, so much capital, assuring the American people that they could keep their doctor, that they could keep their insurance? But of course, as we know, that's just simply not true.
No, you're absolutely right. You know, most people did have insurance. They may not have been happy with the cost. They may not have been happy with the copay, but they had coverage, and it was the best medical treatment in the world. And now they are stuck with the same high cost and less treatment options.
Actually, in a lot of cases, higher costs.
Higher costs.
Because I think
fewer people are covered.
Yeah.
I think fewer people are
afforded. This law is not controlling costs. I mean, there's no question about it. And costs are only, as more of the law rolls out, I mean, in my opinion, and this is something that I've written a lot about as well, that, I mean, if there is going to be a bending of the cost curve, so to speak, to use the president's words, it's going to bend it up.
Well, and I've also heard that the folks that previously didn't have insurance, that ran out and got the Obamacare, very few of them actually made their first premium payment and ended up with no coverage in the end anyway. So, I mean,
have
you heard that?
And even as far as that, that's a great point as well. Even as far as that, according to the government's own estimates, when all is said and done and you've taken the 90% who had insurance and 80 to 85% who were really happy with what they had and kind of turned everything on its head for them, once you've done that, there's still going to be 31 million people in this country in 2024 without health insurance. So we haven't fixed that problem, but we've basically just kind of made everything topsy-turvy for everybody else.
Oh, yeah. You've made it more expensive. You've made it, I think, fewer people able to afford the coverage. It's worse coverage. there's not a lot of pluses.
The trick is that it's and now it's coming out of the taxpayers, which it really wasn't before except for the emergency room thing. But in policies even like ours, it's more efficient. If you look at I used to do the insurance for another company that I worked for and to figure out which plan was best for the employees. And so I'd compare all these plans. Well, as we shopped in the Obamacare crossover and looked at all the plans that were available for my office, the smartest thing you could do would be to go to the emergency room. That was the lowest cost that didn't affect your deductible, because our deductibles are all like $3,000 now and our out-of-pocket's like $11,000. And your short trip is to the emergency room again, which is where we were before.
Which bypasses most of it.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, we have David on the line. He has a question for you.
David?
Go ahead, David.
Oh, morning. Yeah, or noon now.
Yeah.
You know, I heard you talking about health care and, surprise at the idea that this issue of health care has come up in the Obama administration. I'm old enough to remember the beginning of Bill Clinton's term when we were in a dangerous position back then, and it was a massive problem. And it was called Hillary Care back then.
Right.
But all during the 80s, people were dying, and their health care coverage was at a dangerous position. So I take a real exception to the idea that this is something new. But the other angle of it that I'd lean on is that I was interested in going into medicine when I was young. And I studied the economics of it as well as the biology of it. And a healthy, stable economy would only have about 3% of its gross domestic product as health care. But America right now is better than 16%. We've got at least three different epidemics going on right now. We've got a diabetes epidemic. When I was a kid, it might be one person out of 1,000 had diabetes. Now they're talking about one out of two. And the idea that cancer is now getting into one out of two people having cancer, that's a dangerous spot. And the idea that people are laughing because we can sabotage a healthcare system, that's creepy. And I really take exception.
I don't get the part about the laughing. I'm not the doctor, so I'm going to let him respond to everything else. But people are laughing about sabotaging the healthcare system?
Yes, absolutely. The idea of killing, crippling Obamacare, doing what you can do to make sure that it fails. This is sabotage. This is mass murder of America.
Failed.
We've got a cancer epidemic. We've got a diabetes epidemic. We've got a variety of other healthcare problems that are, heart disease. Heart disease in its own range is a massive epidemic and may be directly tied to radiation.
Okay. Hold on 1 second, David.
Sure.
Before we get too far down the road, let's let Dr. Fodeman respond because it's getting bigger. The comments.
Sure. Thanks for the call, Dave. And I mean, I think the real problem here is the law itself is failing, and it's really failing under its own weight. It's too big. It's too complicated. It's too confusing. I mean, as a physician who kind of deals with this stuff on a daily basis, I look at the Affordable Care Act, and I see that this isn't the solution. I mean, this is the problem. There's already too much red tape. There's already too much regulation. There's already too much bureaucracy. And we really need to go in the other direction as far as giving doctors, giving patients more freedom, more flexibility to try to tackle these problems, to make better cost-conscious decisions. And that's really the direction that we need to go in. And again, unfortunately, that isn't the direction the ACA takes us, which is why, in my opinion, things are getting worse under the ACA, and they're only going to get even worse. But hopefully now with the new Senate and the new House and strong Republican leadership, that this is the direction we'll take. Again, I'm not naive enough to think that the president will, who's shunned bipartisanship for 6 years is going to suddenly shift gears. But I would hope that the Republicans can kind of put together some good ideas to try to move things in the right direction, so to speak.
So the idea isn't that we're, that anybody's laughing trying to make healthcare worse. The idea is that, like a lot of things, when you first put them out, if they're not working well, you've got to fix them. And we've identified some stuff.
And the law is making things worse. And I think the real problem, again, was how this law was created. Again, President Obama, once he came into office, he ran on a campaign of bipartisanship and working together and bringing people together. But then what's the first thing he did? He made that conference and waved his finger at Speaker Boehner and said that, or John Boehner, and said that I won. and, you know, proceeded to kind of just go in his own direction. And I think that's the real problem here is there are a lot of good ideas in healthcare in the right, and they're much simpler. It doesn't take 2,900 pages. It doesn't take 159 committees, agencies. It doesn't take a team of consultants, a team of navigators, a billion-dollar website that doesn't work. I mean, what the heck does any of this stuff even have to do with healthcare? And that's the real problem here, because, again, this law was never about healthcare. It was never about bending costs. It was never about proving quality. It was just taking something that, again, wasn't the ideal market, by no means a free market, but taking more of that and shifting it to the federal government. And that's really the main effect of this law. And surprise, surprise, as far as cost, as far as healthcare, as far as access, it's not helping.
Well, government usually is the least efficient deliverer of most services. We've got to take a really quick break, and we'll be back. Thank our advertisers. Thanks, David, for the call. We're being joined by Dr. Fodeman talking about the healthcare law. If you have questions or comments, 530-605-4567. We're here at KCNR 1460 AM.
No. I ain't got no time for that.
Classic.
Ain't nobody got time for that.
You know, I look at all the music from growing up differently now.
We're going to ruin it for
it
you.
It has different applications. Hey, so you're joining We the People Radio. Please join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We're here at KCNR 1460 AM. It's all about healthcare for the next half hour. You can call us at 530-605-4567. So we've got Mike Quinn on the line, who already knew that number. I know Bill wants to ask a question about cancer, but we're going to come back to cancer. We can't leave Mike there forever.
Sure you can. You won't be the first.
Hit it, Mr. Quinn.
Now, the scariest thing about this Obamacare, when you go in and you get your rates and things like that, because that's only an estimate. You do not know how much your annual fee is going to be until they come up to the end of the year, because they base your numbers upon last year's income. If your income goes up, they say, oh, okay, well, your income is too much. They're going to send you another bill.
Get out.
No. No, this is what people are not understanding. If you're complaining about your rates right now, you don't even know what it is. It is an estimate. And if you get your income goes up, they say, oh, well, you should have been paying this last year.
No, I've heard that same thing.
And they
Mike,
can retro people, charge you?
People are
absolutely
afraid.
Absolutely retro.
Yeah, if you get a raise or, you know, you get promoted at work or whatever, you could end up on the losing end of that deal because your health care is going to eat it up and
is more. That only if you're on the subsidies?
Yeah.
Yes, if you're on one of the subsidy programs. And and they're not sure about the other programs either, because they're all based upon paying into one system.
Okay, the only thing that's going to save them is that the IRS took some pretty good cuts at the end of the year, so maybe they could save up enough money to pay the penalty. That's brutal.
Yeah, it is.
Well, the thing is, it's going to be a very, very, you're talking about brutal. By the time the IRS gets all the information and calculates it,
yeah,
you may have 2 years' worth of back payments to make.
Hmm. Yikes.
Because they can't, as soon as you send your return in, they're not going to know what the whole system, whether it made money or not.
Well,
and you would know because you do taxes.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, we all want to be fair, so everybody has to pay their share. Hey, thanks a lot, Mike.
I forgot about the fairness doctrine.
Yeah, sorry, Mike.
And then on the provider side with that as well, as far as a lot of the kind of the documentation, as far as which providers are accepting the exchange plans and stuff like that, a lot of that is just kind of flat out wrong as well. So people might sign up for a plan thinking that their doctor or a doctor that they want to go accepts that insurance, when in reality they might not. So it's not just kind of the dollars and cents of it as far as the misinformation, but also as far as the access and the physician as well.
Well, and I guess if we're piling on, Let's also include the most recent information that the stuff you enter in healthcare.gov is actually being sold to other people, and you know, your information's not secure. Not
no,
that
it's not secure.
Anyone ever thought it was. Oh, bye, Mr. Quinn. Thanks for calling.
Yeah. Hey, you know, I appreciate David calling in because he brought up a great point about cancer that I wanted to expand on a little bit. You know, in spite of the billions of dollars that this country spends every year in cancer research, we can't find a cure. And, you know, my personal opinion is there's more money in treatment than there is a cure. But besides that, I speak from personal experience. You know, my father died of cancer, and I have coworkers who are dealing with cancer right now. And what I've seen is if you are not on a government program like Medicare, Medicaid, you can't afford the cure. And they'll tell you right up front, you know, do you have insurance? Do you, you know, how are you going to pay for the treatment? That's the first thing they're going to ask you. If you do have Medicare, or if you want to file with Medicare, the first thing you have to do is get rid of all your personal belongings, which to me is a crime. You work your whole life and then you end up with cancer and you got to get rid of everything. So as far as the cancer thing goes, Obamacare is not going to help anybody if you end up with cancer. And what have you heard on that?
Sure. I mean, I agree. I mean, as far as, again, my top, I mean, there's a lot of economic issues and a lot of political issues, but my main concern is the patient, the doctor, and medical practice. And those are kind of my top three. And this law, as far as those things, again, there's some kind of radical restructuring of the country, but on those three things, I mean, this law, it's just, as I write in that article for The Hill, I mean, this law does not benefit patients. It's certainly not good for doctors or for the practice of medicine. And like one of some of the things I talked about the Patient Centers Outcomes Research Institute, declining reimbursement, ICAP, the value-based payment modifier. I mean, there's a lot of provisions in this law that kind of, depending on how they're enacted, could definitely be used to prevent patients from getting the care that they need and getting the care that they want. And again, that's not how this law was sold to the American people, but that's the only really way that this law could even come remotely close to controlling healthcare costs in any sort of way.
Well, in the past, did they have to be on Medicare in order to get cancer treatment if they were older? Did they have to get rid of everything and qualify for Medicare? Is that the same or is that new? Do you know?
So in Medicaid, for example, if you have Medicaid and you have a little bit of resources, the federal government can actually come after you as far as kind of going after any sort of assets you have if you use, or even after your beneficiary is, if money is spent. And for example, for this, that's becoming much more of an issue now where we're seeing a huge Medicaid expansion with 15, 20 million new people placed on Medicaid and up to 138% of FTL. So that's becoming definitely more of an issue under the ACA with its Medicaid expansion.
One of our listeners in the chat mentioned that as of January 1st, 2015, if you're getting a subsidy through Obamacare, you'll be paying tax on that as income. Have you heard that?
That I actually was not aware of. But, yeah, again, it's just a really...
Kind of makes sense,
and,
though.
And that's the real problem here. I mean, we're talking about subsidies. We're talking about assets. I mean, we're supposed to be talking about health care. We're supposed to be talking
exactly.
about patients getting the care that they need. We're supposed to talk about improving access. And, I mean, the best really way to do that... I mean, the problem here is that since Medicare, for the past 56 years, basically what we've been trying to do is that we've tried to be basically ramming a square through a circular hole. And it's just not working with a Medicare, a Medicaid system based on price controls where you have a product like healthcare that is so heavily regulated that physicians such as myself that every day see dozens and dozens of ways that I could perhaps do my job better, how I could provide better care, how I could provide more care to more patients, how I could be happier doing what I do, how I can make life easier for my patients. Every day I see dozens and dozens of ways that that could be. But unfortunately, the industry, the product is so heavily regulated that that's just not feasible. And this only regulates it further, making that type of innovation that we need to bend the cost curve even harder. And then at the same time, it's also fueling consolidation, which is only leading to higher prices and also, again, making it harder for the physician to really innovate. And those are the type of things we need to tackle. We need to try to find common sense deregulation areas where we can give physicians a little more control to try to do their jobs a little better. And then at the same time, we need to try to empower patients to give them a little more skin in the game. And that's really kind of what's lacking. And there's several ways to do that. I mean, first off, you should be able to pick a healthcare plan that best meets your needs. So if you're a citizen here in Arizona, but you see a plan in California that has all the packages that you need, all the mandates that you need, but nothing that you don't, and it's a little cheaper, well, you should be able, as a citizen of Arizona, to go out and buy that plan in California, especially if it's cheaper. Then, at the same time, of course, the ACA does, you know, just the opposite by with its essential health benefits, but then at the same time, we also need to do things like extend health savings accounts, for example, to make consumers smarter, more cost-conscious of how they're spending their healthcare dollars at the point of consumption. I mean, for any other thing, whether it's buying gas or buying a gallon of milk.
Yeah, but see, that's where it all goes south, because everything else is free market. You don't have a choice with this. There is no free market here. They're telling you how the game's played, and you have to play it. You can't go out and shop your own like on every other product. And that's, I guess, where I think it really starts to go south.
Well, absolutely.
And the only other market really that's like this is education. And the only other market where you see kind of the price increases like you do in healthcare is education. I mean, they're very, very similar. And it's true. I mean, I'm a reasonable guy, and it's true the idea of a market in healthcare can never be totally perfect. I mean, if you're having, you know, substernal chest pain, that sucks all of a sudden. I mean, the idea that you would kind of make the call, you know, 7 local cath labs, see you as the cheapest cath lab, and go to that hospital. I mean, that's ridiculous, but that's kind of the exception, not the norm. A lot of these things we're talking about with, like, colonoscopies, like back MRIs, with just kind of more routine outpatient stuff. I mean, there was a recent study actually published in JAMA, about price variation just in the state of California on laboratory tests. So laboratory tests are a very objective thing. It's not like a colonoscopy, which you could argue maybe there's some skill set involved and some complexity and some difficulty, just a lab test. And the results were shocking. They found that these very common lab tests that, as a doctor, I order daily, multiple times daily, like a BMP, which is a basic metabolic panel, or a lipid, that the prices ranged from like $30 to $10,000. I mean, just astronomical price differences. So if you could create a system with price transparency where consumers know how much it costs, and then a situation where maybe through a health savings account where consumers have a little incentive to not go to the one where it costs $10,000 and drive the extra mile to the one where it costs $100, I mean, you're talking about real savings here that could really save a lot of money, and that's the direction that I think we need to go in. And these aren't complex. These aren't 2,900-page bills. These aren't new committees, new agencies, programs. I mean, these are really just kind of tweaking the largely successful system that we had and trying to build on its success and make it a little better so we do lower costs and more people can afford and we can afford to bring more into the system.
Right. And you can't do your job without those tests. I mean, you could guess, but I mean,
not really because we haven't.
Yeah, I'm not. I wouldn't be doing that without tort reform.
I was just going to say that.
Another thing.
We skipped tort reform.
But if they're not going to pay for the tests.
I know. What are the choices? I mean, we've got to take a break and then we'll come back because tort reform was on my list. That was my next thing. Because I'm thinking about that. You know, as you guys have to try to work around this, you wind up dancing right into the, you know.
Courtroom.
The storm with tort reform. Okay. Really quick break. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us, here at KCNR, 1460 AM, Shasta Redding. Without that, gotta have this
classic
doctor song on there. All right, so we've got roughly 10 minutes. What about the tort reform? Is any of that coming your way?
I mean, it's definitely something that we need. I mean, if someone, again, and this is really not a today conversation, I mean, this would be a 6 years ago conversation, but if the president was really serious about trying to bend the cost curve, about trying to make our healthcare system a little more patient-centered, a little better, a little cheaper. I mean, there's really two things that I think you could have done that would have produced substantial savings and really been a great first step in the right direction, and that would have been buying insurance across state lines and then tort reform. And tort reform is really something that we need to talk about because it's something that it's really needed. First off is just the price of rising malpractice premiums, but then the real impact where tort reform does have an effect and where it could save money is the practice of defensive medicine. And basically what defensive medicine is, it's kind of ordering extra tests, extra consults, extra procedures that your patient really may not need. But a physician does it not out of, say, medical necessity, but they do it really to protect themselves from the possibility of a lawsuit in the future. And it's something that, as a doctor, it's something that I do, all us physicians do on a regular basis. And, I mean, we're talking about billions and billions of dollars, and it's something, there's been estimates, you know, 50, 100, 200, it's the type of thing that no one really knows for sure, and it's the type of thing that would, it's really a cultural thing, it's the type of thing that would take a lot to change, but it is something that tort reform could have an effect on, and I think it would save money, and then at the same time would also make our healthcare system just a lot better, because a lot of these extra tests, extra procedures, extra interventions, they don't just have a cost. But they all have
benefit.
They all have side effects, and
sure.
They all, a lot of times they can lead to other tests. So you can get a CAT scan with contrast, and you can get kidney damage. You can get a CAT scan for one thing, and it doesn't show what you thought it would show or what you did it, but then you pick up a little nodule in the lung or in the liver, and now you're getting an MRI, or now you're getting, you know, another set of CAT scans for the next 2 years to look at that lung nodule. So there's a lot of unintended consequences, and another unintended consequences of the unnecessary test is the opportunity cost of it taking away resources from those who actually need it.
Mm-hmm. Well, so now, what about preventative type medicine, though? Is it covered? I mean, do they pay for the preventative?
But he's talking defensive. So basically, yeah, you're defending yourself
from
suits.
They're a little different. So this isn't preventative medicine, which is trying to get diseases early, which most insurances do cover. This is defensive medicine, where a doctor is ordering a test, not really a test that's medically indicated, but a test really more just because of our litigious system, and a doctor doesn't want to get sued. And again, we're talking about billions and billions of dollars that if there was some way we can kind of curb this culture, which tort reform could potentially do. Unfortunately, again, there's no tort reform in the ACA except for a few demonstration projects, but, you know, we know this is something that's needed, and we know that's something that works, but unfortunately, physicians aren't as powerful and as connected as those trial lawyers.
Yeah, that's a pretty big lobby you're up
against. Yeah, and the medical, the big medical lobby that just AMA. Basically AMA sold you guys down the river.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I wouldn't even consider the AMA a doctor's organization or
right.
a doctor's lobby.
Saying.
I mean, they get only about 14% of practicing physicians actually belong to the AMA. I of course are not, and they get most of their money from they have some of the rights to the CPT codes, which is like the billing thing. So they're basically really a government funded monopoly, and that's where they get their money from. And that was unfortunately really their priority in the healthcare debate, and it wasn't the patient, and it certainly wasn't doctors.
Well, how, now that this thing has been around for a few years, how is this affecting guys that you know that are in practice, ladies, I guess, doctors in general? Are you seeing people leave like we thought would happen? Because we're seeing that here.
Sure. I mean, as far as affecting physicians really on a microeconomic level, I mean, you have to remember that a lot of the law really hasn't even been written yet, with its secretary shells and its committees and its agencies. So as far as how it's affecting me on a daily basis, I mean, there definitely is more. It has created more paperwork in certain respects, but it really hasn't been too big of an effect. I mean, one way it did affect me is obviously I'm a very kind of free market and very autonomous and very independent young physician, and I would much rather be a private practice doctor. I would much rather be doing like a concierge medical practice or a direct pay or something like that, as opposed to an employed model physician. And while I would definitely prefer the former, I just deal with a lot of uncertainty surrounding the ACA, and, you know, who knows what's going to happen as far as the future of private practice and the future of direct pay models. So, you know, so that had some impact on me as far as the job that I took. So in that respect, it definitely did have effect, because I think that's definitely kind of risky. But there definitely are, I mean, older doctors who are nearing retirement, kind of close to retirement, and not just the ACA, but with the electronic health record kind of being shoved down our throat, with the stimulus law and then ICD-10 on the horizon, which is the new billing and coding software, which is basically takes the number of codes from, you guys might have heard about this, basically takes the number of billing codes from about 18,000 to, I think it's 164,000, with Jeez. Codes for struck by duck, bit by duck.
Yeah, hit by a flaming duck on water skis. Yeah, we heard some.
it would be funny if it wasn't true. You can't make this stuff up. I mean, it's just absurd. But so with all those kind of three things, yes, a lot of older doctors are definitely nearing retirement, and my guess is that there's probably a lot of younger people, maybe 5-10 years younger than myself, who looking at medicine and would have normally might have gone to that, but now they're going to be a nurse or a nurse practitioner or a PA or get an MBA or something like that. So it definitely is having an effect, and as more of the perverse incentives get ingrained in our system, there's only going to be more.
More surprises, not less. So, so do you think, we've got like a minute left, but I just was kind of curious, would you be more in favor of peeling away pieces of it and replacing it with things that work, or getting rid of the whole thing and starting over, if it was your magic wand to wave?
Sure. Well, again, I don't think the president is going to be too amenable to either with everything.
No, it's a magic wand, not a realistic
wand. Showed us in the past 6 years. But, I mean, again, if I had my way, and again, I don't really think we can start over at this point either, because unfortunately, you know, people have made decisions based on the law and what they think it's going to affect, and often it's affecting the future of hospital operations, and people are making decisions based on this law that will be very hard to kind of overturn. So I don't necessarily think it could be. If it could, I mean, my preference, and I think the best thing, would be to definitely start over and kind of start with the direction that I talked about, and kind of
get rid of all the 159 different.
Yeah, I think if insurance companies had the ability to write private policies again, I think it would squeeze it out slowly and it'd go away.
Exactly. Dr. Jason Fodeman, thank you for spending an hour with us. We'd love to have you back, and we could talk about other pieces and parts. So you know how to find us. Let us know when you've got other articles out, and we'd love to have you on.
Thank you very much.
I have a real pleasure to be here, and I'll definitely take you up on that. I'd love to be back on the show.
Yep. We love to have experts on so we can find out what they know. We'll be back. We'll be back in 5 minutes after the news, and we're going to pick up with Patrick Wood where we left off last week on Technocracy. Don't miss it.